Welcome, everybody, to The Rad Life, the only talk radio show that takes you along with host and age explorer Rod Gontos on his continuing journey of discovery into life's challenges, opportunities, options, and all the latest and greatest things that come with getting older. The Rad Life is brought to you this week by Your Home for a Lifetime, a company dedicated to empowering you to stay safely, independently, and comfortably in your own home. And now here is your host, Rad Gontos.
Rad Gontos is in the house, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, wait. Let's get his mic up.
Hello.
Okay.
No, I don't know. Are you cutting me off?
Well, if you're going to...
Just because I threatened you off
the air? You're
going
to threaten to out me here. Yeah, exactly.
I don't recall using those words.
You should have heard the political incorrect conversations.
I'm telling you, people only knew the kind of conversation that take place when we're not on the air. They think it's bad enough when we are on the air.
Oh, it's worse. It's much worse.
It's like you know, World Wrestling Federation meets what?
Jerry Springer.
What was that show? Where everybody was sitting around the table. It was a political show. It was on TV, and it was
politically incorrect.
No. And it was a guy who was always talking like this. We remember that? It was like something, the something report or something. It was like,
oh, the McLaughlin
report. The McLaughlin report.
I love the McLaughlin.
Yeah, so the McLaughlin report meets World Wrestling Federation with a little of just completely incorrect, politically incorrect.
John McLaughlin was funny. He would go, he'd say, yes or no, Trump's going to last? He's not. You know, he'd say this and he'd be like, well, I don't know.
But he was the only one who did that.
Yeah.
Now everybody basically operates on that show. on that black and white matrix, right? Okay. Anyway, we are not going to go down that path.
No.
Because we pretty much actually have a pretty, I think personally, pretty raw conversation lined up for today.
Yeah, I think so. We're going to get your guest very close.
I want to introduce my guest. So please, if you are watching and you happen to be on the live feed on Facebook, say hello to my guest, Michael Sweet, who is here representing the Michael J. Fox Foundation and his own personal experience, because Michael is...
I am a early onset Parkinson's disease patient.
When were you diagnosed?
November of 2008.
So you have been diagnosed for...
Gosh, it's...
What, six, seven, 8 years almost?
Yeah, almost eight years is coming the end of this
year. Oh, actually, almost 10 years.
Oh, gosh.
The end of this year, right?
2018, right. Yeah.
So 9+ years you've been diagnosed.
Yes.
Okay. And so let's just set the stage with your own personal situation, mm-hmm. and then we'll switch it to the foundation, to the amazing foundation.
And then we'll segue into the connections we had because we were both from Minnesota.
There you go.
Can we get those out of the way?
Let's have the happy talk out of the way.
No,
we're not going to do the happy talk.
We're
going to save the happy talk till later.
Okay. Because we got to talk about the Vikings somewhere.
Okay.
Along
so,
the way
so here. Michael, you were diagnosed 9+ years ago,
right?
With what was referred to at that time as early onset.
Well, at the time they didn't have a label. No, they just Parkinson's.
It was just Parkinson's, right?
But since there's been people diagnosed in their 50s or 40s, 30s. I know of a person just recently that was diagnosed at 15.
Oh, I was shocked. I was looking at some of the stuff when I was doing the little teaser that we put out.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously the numbers are not that big. The majority of the numbers are still in the later age brackets,
right.
but they're ironically in later age brackets. They're not like 60 plus.
Right.
There's also actually younger, which really was frightening for me. But also, there were cases as young as 6 years old.
Yeah.
So, and you're talking about something that impacts, or maybe I guess diagnosis-wise, something in the range of 200,000 plus people in the United States every year.
Right.
Right? Now, my question to you, first and foremost, what is Parkinson's? Let's get everybody kind of up on the same...
Because
most people don't have an understanding.
Right.
Like, they
everybody thinks Parkinson's is, like I spoke earlier, the 80-year-old grandpa sitting in a rocking chair with their hand shaking.
Right.
The ultimate diagnosis of what Parkinson's disease is your receptor in your brain that produces the dopamine, which, of course, creates your highs and lows and emotions.
Right.
A Parkinson's patient they don't produce enough of it, where a normal healthy individual produce 90 to 100% dopamine production, depending on their emotion.
Right.
A patient like myself produces about 25%.
Wow. So it's a substantially lower amount of dopamine. Yeah.
And the dopamine controls motion.
Right. No. Yeah. That controls speech, too. It controls your emotions, your...
Can I just say something? Just
emotions have, and
just,
your emotions.
Just have like a flippant moment, okay? As emotionally out of control as people are these days,
right?
Okay, it actually doesn't sound so bad.
No,
to actually have only 25% of
to dial down
their dopamine. Because there's a whole bunch of people that I basically get exposed to everything from news to otherwise that I would love to dial down their dopamine. Yeah.
Oh,
right.
And let me just chime in.
I'm not making fun of it. I'm just saying.
Oh,
I'm
no,
saying
I agree. Yeah. I agree 100%.
Let me chime in and point out some other connections. Obviously, on the show, we point out that my mother had Parkinson's, my late mother, for many years, which made her life miserable. And we'll talk about those, what that did to her life.
My grandfather, like I said, how old were you when you got diagnosed? I mean, that's what, I mean.
It's 40 years old. Is exactly the process actually took 2 years
to get diagnosed,
but the words you have Parkinson's. Hold on a
second, Paul. So you were diagnosed and you got the word that you had Parkinson's at the age of 40.
Yeah.
So technically you were kind of dealing with it from the age of 38.
Right.
Okay. Paul, when did your mom get diagnosed? How old was she?
Well, that's the whole, I got to give a little explanation here for a second. Parkinson's is observational. There is no test for it. So you can't go get tested and see if you have it. And I think he had the best explanation for it. In our family, as in many Irish families, for some reason, I don't know why it runs through Irish communities, but there is what's known as motion disorder, familiar tremor. Mm-hmm. And I have had that since I was a little child. And my aunt had it. My mother had it. So they could never decide if she really just had a really bad case of familiar tremor, of essential tremor. It's really what it's called.
Well, what is essential tremor?
Let him define it. He had a perfect way to describe it here. The difference between essential tremor and Parkinson's.
What's
My doctor had, who is a neurologist, he's not just, he's a movement disorder specialist.
Yeah.
He defined to me the difference between Parkinson's and essential tremor is Parkinson's is an at rest. You're not doing anything. Your arm's just sitting there and it maybe starts shaking or stiffens up with dystonia. Essential tremor is something where you pick up a knife and you're buttering bread and you start shaking at that point.
It's an activity.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. So one's at rest, one's at movement.
But I'll show you mine because it's been doing it today.
It's quite there a little bit.
Yeah, your thumb. I can see it.
Yeah, I can brush my thumb.
Yeah.
And so I had that my whole life. My aunt had it. My mother had it. And we thought it was just getting worse and worse. My aunt, you would think, is borders on Parkinson's. She has it so bad. But it's that difference of if you're doing it at rest or if you're doing it every time you move. Mm-hmm. And for many years, they couldn't decide. And my mother would fight the diagnosis and my dad would fight it. But most of the doctors agreed she had Parkinson's. And as this gentleman said earlier to me, I didn't know this, you can have both. Mm-hmm. You know, we've always worried. I worry. My fear that it hangs over my head is, will I end up like her? Well, will this progress?
But if it's a amount of dopamine,
correct,
and it's a 20, like in your case, 25% of what is normal,
mm-hmm.
then I'm assuming it's something they can measure for.
They're guesstimations.
Okay. I mean, how do you measure dopamine? I mean, it can't be observational.
It's kind of like how the NFL players are donating their brains and they're discovering CTE after the fact.
Right. So it's cadavers and postmortems. Okay.
Right.
So part of the frustration is that you don't know if you really have it and you can deny having it, but it's observational. As it gets worse and worse, something's going on.
Right.
And there are various degrees of it.
Unfortunately, from the sound of things, is that it gets really diagnosed when it is so obvious it's unavoidable.
Right.
Right. And that's exactly what happened in my case. And like I said, it was a 2-year period, but I was at a doctor's appointment with my wife and sitting in the corner, and our doctor at the time looked at me and said, you nervous or what's going on over there?
Why are you shaking?
Yeah, and I said, I don't know. It's been going on for a while. I said, I think I pinched a nerve while I was mowing the yard. And he goes, that doesn't look right. And so at the end of my wife's appointment, he spent a little time with me, referred me off to just a basic neurologist. Right. And the way you get diagnosed is you're tested for multiple sclerosis and Wagner's. And
so they rule everything else out.
Yeah, but once you rule everything out that – most of them are actually more horrifying than Parkinson's disease. So you're one relieved, I don't have any of those.
Right.
And then you kind of have to go into the doctor's office and have you walk up and down the hallway.
So Michael, what just to give people sort of a point of perspective, what did you do before you were diagnosed? What was your life like? And then what would happen as a direct, or you could relate to have been a direct result of that diagnosis? How did your life change? So give people an idea what your normal life was. I'm not saying that your life is not normal now,
right.
But what was your reality prior to diagnosis?
Prior to diagnosis, I was in a managerial position for a local healthcare firm. We did billing for all the hospitals in Southern California. It didn't matter if it was private pay or insurance. I was supervised the area that had that.
So you had people under you.
Yeah.
You were overseeing pretty at least mathematical processes.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. And I had about 25 people underneath me.
Proper procedures, all that stuff.
Right. And I had to, make sure that the books were online and, analytics of the way accounts were flowing through.
Well, and you were dealing with bookkeeping, I'm assuming, for other entities,
right?
For billing.
Yeah.
So you were responsible not just only to the people that were working for you, but you were also responsible for the people that were hiring you to do the tasks.
Correct. Okay. And did that. And then in my spare time, I coached football with my sons in youth football. I was out coaching them and helping them. And the diagnosis hit. And I fought, like I said, for 2 years. I fought with dealing with, the tremors and missing work because you just couldn't get out of bed. And, and my work started getting a little frustrated with me. And once I got the diagnosis, my doctor said, you just need to leave because you're stressed at your job.
It's too stressful a situation for you.
Right. And, having customers call and yell and scream at you on the phone and then your boss asking why your department's not reaching its, quarterly goal. And
right.
I just couldn't handle it. And I went ahead and took his recommendation and retired. And that was probably one of the hardest times in our life because my wife and I, we were in a really good point. She also worked for the same company. We made decent money for our age level, owned a home, owned two cars, had a car, bought a car for our daughter, and, everything was doing great. Mm-hmm. I go out on disability and apply for Social Security, which nobody tells you, hey, you got to wait 6 months before you can apply and then can take however long. So during that process, we ended up having to short sell our home and lost our home, had a car repossessed. There would be days I can remember going to one of my sons, my youngest, who I, 10 years ago, so he's 12 years old, and he had his allowance and saying, hey, I take some of your allowance to go, get some bread. And he did it, but it upset him so bad. And he wasn't mad at me, wasn't mad at my wife. He was mad at
the circumstances.
Yeah, just the situation of what was going on. And I saw no end to it. And it put a big strain on my wife and I.
Which a lot of people usually don't realize just the emotionality of situations.
Right, because you don't. I mean, my wife and we were married I was 19, she was 18, in March we'll be celebrating our 30th anniversary. And so we're kind of out of the ordinary for getting married that young.
Sure, but, absolutely. Congratulations.
Thank you. But she...
Well, it is definitely a testament too, given the fact that you've had to deal with what you've had to deal with.
Right, because at 18 years old, you can't tell me my wife was going, gee, by the time 40, he's 40, he's going to have Parkinson's, not working, and possibly be bedridden or taking 30 pills a day, and and I don't know what I'm going to get.
Well, and all the emotionality that you are individually going through to adjust and even deal and come to terms with this, and then the impact it has on everybody around you.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Especially living in the same household. I mean, I'm not gonna mention who, but I mentioned to you a situation with somebody else I know, where he wasn't as fortunate to have that support stick around. And we talk about it all the time, relevant to caregiving, or people that are going through dealing with their parents, and whether not even hospice prior to that, and all the stress that it does, and on the interdynamics of a family and relationships and. People that, especially if you're under one house and you got kids, your kids were like, you're saying, was that your youngest or oldest that was 12?
My youngest was 12. I had a 12, a 16, and an 18-year-old.
Yeah, but so you pretty much had teens in the house. And here's dad basically diagnosed with Parkinson's and basically looking to be on disability. And, talk about a change of complete life in their household.
Right, because, my daughter... she had, of course, a rough life in probably the first 7-8 years of her life, but then we got great jobs.
Right.
And so she was able to have, not the brand new, but she had bought her a little Toyota mini pickup truck.
Yeah.
And, so she got those things. And then how do you turn around and explain to the two boys
to give that to them
why they can't have it?
Right.
And that was the hardest thing for me as. What's supposed to be the head of the household, the man of the family.
Well, and that's the other thing, Michael, right? Because there are certain gender roles that we play, or maybe it's not so much gender roles, but roles that we play within relationships and dynamics.
Right.
And so that's another thing that you have to face the reality of, that this is affecting that particular core role that you see yourself in. And like you said, you got married young.
Right.
So this is a long established dynamic that you have as far as a family structure and the relationship with your wife. Yeah. So 6 months to file.
Right.
For what is it? Disability or Social Security?
Social Security disability.
Okay. Social Security disability payments, basically.
SSDI.
Right. And was it easy to do that? Was it just the duration, or was it also a complex situation given the fact of the reasoning? Did you find that it was receptive? I hear a lot of people sometimes with other forms of disability that is, there's a lot of inquiry and there's a lot of, dragging out. You go through, literally through the ringer to get to that point where you basically qualify.
Yeah.
What was your experience in actually applying?
There is a lot of miscommunication because I was told by my employer that there was a 6-month waiting period you had before, and I was told before you could apply.
Mm-hmm.
And to find out, it wasn't that. It was a 6-month waiting period from the time you applied. So I could have applied immediately.
Oh, wow.
So when I left in November,
so you ended up with a year versus 6 months.
Right. So
wow.
I waited 6 months. I applied. And of course, during this whole time, my wife are going back and forth. When are you applying? Why aren't you getting money? What's going on? And it's like, I have to wait. And, when
6 months is a very long time. A year is even longer.
Oh, it was.
When you're dealing with something like that.
Right. I mean, we had a $2,800 mortgage payment that my wife was trying to do on her own, and it just wasn't working. And so when I finally did apply, 6 months later, I got a letter in the mail from Social Security saying, please come to the local office. Mm-hmm. I went down there as expecting to have to go through who's my doctor and all this. And he had filled out paperwork. My name got called. I walked back there and she said, oh, hi. Okay. Well, how old are your children? Okay. Well, this one's under 18. So he gets a benefit. You get a benefit.
There's the formula for
you're also going to get back paid over the past 6 months, and your payment should be there in 3 weeks. So I fortunately was the easy case, and it was everything to do with my doctor. He filled out the form correctly. He wrote that it was debilitating, that it would affect my work and that I could not work. And, you know, it's a lot of people
took all the ifs and whats and buts out of it for them.
Right.
When they process the paperwork. Now, is that a common experience with people that are filing with Parkinson's as a reason?
No, I have a friend who unfortunately was diagnosed with MS, and her and her husband, they had to hire attorneys. They went about 3.5 years before she was given her Social Security. It may have been longer even.
So, Michael, do you think a bunch of that is just the bureaucratic process, or mm-hmm. is it actually a fundamental misunderstanding or lack of understanding of what it really is as a disease, Parkinson's specifically? Or is it both?
I think it's a little bit of both. Okay. Because every, you know, the saying somebody had said last year, well, is actually the Michael J. Fox had said it at our forum last year, is the common ground is people have this attitude that you've seen one Parkinson's patient, you've seen every Parkinson's patient.
Yeah, they used to do the same thing about Alzheimer's.
Yeah. And
it wasn't that long ago that it was just one blanket statement. Right. Alzheimer's. Now there's all multiple different categories.
Yeah, and the reality is if you've seen one Parkinson's patient, you've seen one Parkinson's patient.
Right.
And unfortunately, Social Security views, like I said, I was extremely lucky to get approved right off the bat. That's not the common story with 40-year-olds, 30-year-olds applying for Social Security.
Now, is the doctor that helped you with that still your doctor?
Yes, okay. He is.
You know what? Let's give him a plug if you're okay with it.
Oh, absolutely.
Because I think that's, you know, kudos.
Because, I mean, I'll tell you, he wasn't my first doctor. He was my second. I went to him. His name's Dr. Omid Omidvar. He works at Southland Neurological Institute. They have offices in Long Beach and Los Alamitos. And I, honest to God, will say to you and to anybody who asked me that question, Dr. Omidvar saved my life, because I'm losing my home, I'm losing cars, I feel like I'm losing my family, literally felt, and I, in some ways, was losing my mind.
Well, I can hear it in your voice right now, even.
Yeah, and I hate the word, but suicide wasn't a far thought from my head.
You know, that's fair enough. I mean, that's one of those things that I think we need to accept as being part of sometimes where we go.
Yeah.
When it looks really bleak, and for a split second, whether you act on it or not, sometimes that is part of what you experience.
Yeah. Without this man in my life, I mean, he gave me a cell phone number. He would FaceTime me. I no longer went to see a primary care physician. Mm-hmm. If I had a cold, I went and saw him. He meant that much to me. And
he wasn't really just your physician. I mean, it sounds like he was your support system.
Oh, he was 100% my support system.
Speaking of support systems, were there in 2008 support systems that you could find easily, let alone?
Not that I could find. What I ended up doing is I went on Facebook and typed in Parkinson's support, and nothing came up.
In 2008, nothing came up on Facebook for Parkinson's support.
Right, except for create group. And I was like, okay.
Wow.
So I created a group, and I titled it Young Onset Parkinson's Disease Support, and waited for somebody to join. And his friend of mine, his name was Vinny, he's from New York. He joined. We started talking back and forth. A couple other people joined, and we got a conversation. I started learning more and more that I wasn't alone. I wasn't the free sideshow freak.
Which is super critical, right? I mean, I mean, sometimes I've talked to some people that are dealing with difficulties, and it's super critical that you have that sense, but it's really kind of an irony, double-sided, two-edged sword, because sometimes when you're going through something, you feel like there's a certain uniqueness about you because you're going through it. So when you find out that there are other people that are going through it, there's a part of it that's relief.
Oh,
and then there's another part of it that's like, well, God dang it, I can't basically feel sorry for myself anymore because I'm not the only one there, right? It's like somebody took away my little pedestal that I'm standing on and saying, hey, look at me. I need my your attention.
Yeah. And that's exactly what happened is it it made me, you know,
which is very empowering. I just think it's kind of funny because those both feelings happen usually.
Yeah, as my wife would say, it made me man up.
Yeah,
to the fact that I have a disease and I need to do something about it and stop laying in bed whining and moaning and crying that I have Parkinson's, my life's over, and Vinny helped me get through that. And this,
and Vinny's the gentleman from New York.
Yeah, okay. And you know, and
that you met basically online on.
Yeah, I've never. And was unfortunately never able to meet him. He passed away about 18 months ago from complications of Parkinson's. But he's another person.
How old is Vinny?
Vinny, when he passed away, was 47.
Wow.
So, and it was heart-wrenching to get that email from his wife. To know the first, you know, real kind of encounter that I had with somebody that could relate to exactly what I was going through wasn't there anymore. Yeah. But that two person, myself and Vinny, has blossomed, exploded, however you want to put it.
What happened to that support group? That you
We now have three total support groups. Okay. There's the Facebook won't let you change the name, right. So it's still Young Onset, even though it's just a general Parkinson's support. Has a little over 4,000 members, which then I had people asking, hey, I'm a caregiver. I really don't want to ask questions or complain.
I want the support from other caregivers.
Yeah, you know, so how do you do? So I started one, so it's strictly caregivers only. That's a little over 2,000
which
members.
Which we forget about also that it's, you know, sometimes the caregiver is a family member. But in a lot of times, the caregiver may not be related by blood, and those are people that also carry that emotional impact that of giving, you know, being of service and caring for people, right?
Yeah, I view every child of mine's a caregiver. My aunt's a caregiver. Yeah. My grandkids are caregivers. Yeah. I mean, they see me
in their own way. I'm sure.
Yeah, they see me shaking, and they know that if they come over and start rubbing Papa's arm, it's, you know, gonna, you know, help me and it make me feel better. So, you know, so all told, between that simple little conversation with me and Vinny, we got a little over 9,000 members between the three groups.
That's phenomenal.
And it's which introduced me through meeting, you know, different people through there, introduced me into the advocacy world with Parkinson's Action Network, which then was joined in with Michael J. Fox Foundation.
Now, Michael J. Fox Foundation, when was that formed?
Oh, gosh.
It wasn't that long ago.
No, I don't have an exact date, but it was in the early 2000s, I would guess.
Yeah.
And it
was pretty fast after he basically was diagnosed, I think, right?
Well, when he came out.
When he came out, sorry.
Yeah, it was shortly after that. Right. And, you know, people... what the Fox Foundation does, it's amazing. I mean, they cover every avenue from helping people to pay for their medications, mm-hmm. to conducting clinical trials, mm-hmm. to, you know, what I do is go to Washington, D.C. and meet with Congress and senators. I mean, there's nothing.
I'm going to look it up. I think it was something like $750 million that they have spent.
Oh, yeah.
And there was something about the that I was impressed. There was local representation.
Mm-hmm.
There was volunteer. There was multiple ways that you could get involved.
Yeah.
With the organization, what do you think happened when he basically came out and basically founded the foundation? What did that mean to Parkinson's?
It made it real because prior to Michael J. Fox, and everybody remembers that picture of Muhammad Ali lighting mm-hmm. the torch mm-hmm. and shaking. But Muhammad Ali, people viewed his Parkinson's as
the direct result of his being a boxer.
Yeah, being a boxer and getting beaten up. And right. Michael J. Fox put a reality to it that you could be a young, successful person, and this disease is indiscriminate. It didn't care that he was from Canada. It didn't care that he was rich. It didn't care that he was an actor. It didn't care that he was actually, I think when he got his original diagnosis, and don't beat me up at the forum, Michael, if you hear this, but I believe he was in his like 29, 30 years old when he was actually diagnosed. It was during when he was filming Back to the Future.
Wow.
Can I just, I've been listening contently, quietly to this conversation here. And one of the things back when I was an entertainment publicist back in the 80s, nobody knew that Michael J. Fox had anything like this. It was kept very quiet. And when he finally couldn't deny it any longer and was coming out, one of the things that was pointed out was how he hid it for years. Mm-hmm. And the way he acted and the way he was shot never from his left side. My familiar tremor is mostly on my left side. I don't know why the left side is predominant in a lot of these cases. And you can go back and look at when he was on what was the show where he's the junior mayor? I forgot now. Famous show.
You're talking about Family Ties?
No, Spin City.
When he was on Spin City for years and all these other things, you can see how he was always hiding the left side of his hand.
Right.
And he was always, if he was had to hold something in his left hand or do something, he was holding something to stabilize it or is holding on to something. And so he learned very carefully how to cover this and mask this, being the actor he is. And because it's frightening, it's fearful.
It's fear of the unknown too, right? I mean, this is something that you see somebody going through,
right?
And it you know, as much as you don't want to be put back, it puts you back.
Yeah. And
so it's even more like, okay, see you later. Kind of, you want to extricate yourself out of that situation.
My mother's two biggest problems with the disease, and we'll assume she did have Parkinson's and not really bad essential tremor, but it makes no difference. It was the same problem. Was that one, she became unstable and fell. Two, she became terribly embarrassed, wouldn't go anywhere, she thought everybody was staring at her. And, you know, that then made her so weak because she wouldn't walk and she wouldn't go anywhere that it took nothing to take her life eventually here.
Right. I have a good friend of mine that basically was diagnosed a number of years ago now, and he was very involved, very active, very involved, very, you know, like standing at a podium and telling it like it is kind of thing. And he actually moved out of town to somewhere else because it's a small town.
Right.
San Clemente is a small town. And I think part of it, I've never really talked to him about it, but I felt that part of it was he just did not want to be seen by others in a different manner than from what he presented authentically to the community, especially when he was that involved in it.
So I think the greatest gift that Michael J. Fox did is not just to raise awareness to it, but to make it okay, where we accept seeing people shake like it's the worst thing in the world. Because the majority of people I knew, my mother, if they're like my mother, and even me, I get with my familiar tremor, people have looked at me and said, what are you drunk or what do you got a problem? Or I actually had somebody, a client, say to me, take me aside once and say, do you have a drinking problem? Like I have delirium tremors. And so you're always trying to hide it. You're always feeling embarrassed about it. And for him to go out and act and like what's the most recent series he was on, the lawyer, or he was playing?
Boston Legal.
Boston Legal. But the other one he was on as a recurring character, The Good Wife.
Yes.
And he's playing an actor with a lawyer with Parkinson's disease. And it was kind of clever because he would use that to his advantage to get sympathy and stuff in the show from the juries and stuff. And they're always like, oh, there he goes again doing that thing here, you know, just to make himself seem sympathetic.
To normalize it.
So he was trying to, and the character, turns around and uses it to sympathize, get sympathy from the juries. All of that makes it normal. In the same way that every other disease and every other condition, people come out. You know, we have a guy at our church who had a bad stroke, and he's an usher. And I just say, what bravery to go. He drags himself up and down the aisle every Sunday to the point where nobody notices anymore. But the first time, you can't help but stare.
Well, I want to do this because we're going to run out of time before we give this out. I want to give out the website for the Michael J. Fox Foundation. It's michaeljfox.org. Right?
We're correct.
And it was actually founded in 2000.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure when this was written in Wikipedia, but it said that the established by actor Michael J. Fox in 2000, the foundation has since become the largest nonprofit funder of Parkinson's disease research in the world investing more than $650 million in research to date. So whatever the to date is, that's the thing. And it's funded research and ensuring the development of improved therapies for these living with Parkinson's disease. Because there's no cure, right?
Not
that we know. Yeah.
There's things that could help.
Right. And that's the sad point is, I mean, people in the Parkinson's community, they'll know the drug Sinemet. And that's the gold standard. That, you know, that's been around, you know, it's levodopa. And I mean, it's helped in it. Dopamine or levodopa was in a movie called Awakenings with Robin Williams and Robert De Niro. Sure. So that's been around forever. And the newest drug that's come out on the market is called Rytary or Rytary, however you want to pronounce it. And unfortunately, all it is carbidopa and levodopa. Same thing as Sinemet. It just enters your system differently. And it crosses because the problem with Parkinson's, you have to get your medications to cross through what's called the blood-brain barrier.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, Rytary does that a little bit quicker, does it more effectively than Sinemet does. There's other medications out there that, you know.
And how expensive are these medications? How available? How expensive?
Sinemet's pretty. My mother tried Sinemet.
Yeah, Sinemet cost me $5.
Sinemet's been around for a long time.
And, any advancements in therapies, do they get on the markets quick enough?
No.
Now there was somebody who did. We had. Well, I think they were on one of our shows actually, and they claimed that Parkinson's could be helped or managed through, and I want to say it's like boxing or something. Or?
Yeah, the Rock City Boxing.
Rock City
the name
Boxing.
Of it.
Yeah.
It is, and that's kind of the new wave thing. Is it's not hardcore punching, you know, but it's just movements. You know, you get.
So is it strengthening?
It's core strengthening. It's keeping because
kind of reprogramming your body a little,
yeah,
little
you
bit.
Yeah, with Parkinson's, you know, the tremors itself. You'd think your arm shaking all day, you're going to be Popeye. But the reality is you have muscle atrophy and your muscles kind of disintegrate and, you know, go through it if tremor is your main source.
So actually exercise helps.
Oh, absolutely. It does.
And the other thing that I think needs to be pointed out, as much as you notice
on
the outside.
That's one of those things that you don't know. I don't know that a lot of people talk about.
No. On the outside, my mother used to complain even more about the inside. She felt she was shaking.
Yeah. And that's my... I'm not atypical. Atypical Parkinson's is, like you said, left side tremor. I am definitely not atypical. I depending on the situation, I do get a right-handed tremor. But I'm what's called dystonia muscle cramping, freezing up, speech. I kind of take a while to talk. It takes me a while to get thoughts out. Mm-hmm. And I have this just, it's unexplainable, but it feels like the inside of my body is shaking, like my organs are shaking.
That's so what on, used to so drive on my mother
so
crazy.
Just to give people an idea of the reality you're dealing with. So on an average week or whatever the duration is, what's a good day with being somebody who's diagnosed with Parkinson's? What is a bad day for you?
Today's a good day. I woke up. I was able to make myself breakfast, drove my son to work, came home, didn't have to worry about cutting my face up, shaving, drove myself here. You know, so it's a good day. I'm functioning and, you know, no problems.
What's a bad day?
A bad day is... It's
can't go out, can't move, can't do anything.
I wake up in the morning and I am literally laying flat. My legs are straight, my feet are straight up, but my toes are curled over. My hands are locked in a claw position. I'm grasping for my medication. I take Rytary. I take 2 pills 4 times a day of that. Then on top of that, if I have a bad day, I have Sinemet that is a rescue medication. Of how I use it, I can take 3, 4, 5 pills of that. There, Azilect, which is another medication, Comtan. I take a blood pressure medication called isradipine, but that is my doctor found this out before clinical trials knew about it, is that ratapentin helps tremors.
Mm-hmm. So a little side effect.
Yeah, it's just something that helps. But a good day, I'll take 10 pills, and you're seeing right now, you're seeing a good day.
Are you able to still work, or have you had to give up work?
The side effects of the pills, the draining, the tired, all of the stuff that they tell you if you're on medication.
Right.
Yeah, and lethargic.
Earlier, I wasn't trying to pay you off by grabbing my wallet out, but there's...
We accept that.
I thought I was going to get something.
The National Parkinson's Foundation, it's another group out there. This is what they give out, and I don't carry that as a joke. I carry that as legitimate in case I got pulled over by a police officer.
So let me read this. Medical alert, I have Parkinson's disease, which could make me move slowly and have difficulty standing or speaking.
Wow.
And in bold, it says, Parkinson's disease is in bold, and it says, next line is, I am not intoxicated. Please call my family or physician for help.
And
then Michael's information is on the inside.
Yeah, and it's, they're great. It's just www.parkinsons.org. They'll send you a little, a bag with pamphlets, this card, a bracelet, a medical alert bracelet. They send it out to you for free.
The reason you have it in your wallet is what? It's sort of like your license. You're gonna pull it at the same time.
If you're driving, you get pulled over. And I've always had.
But if you reach for your wallet, and what I'm saying is if you're moving slow and somebody's questioning it, having it in your wallet.
Can I give you a real life example? Yeah. I've never shared this with anybody, but I'll share this since he's being so incredibly open here. I don't have. To the best of my knowledge, I don't have Parkinson's. I have something similar called essential tremor. It could be related. They're not sure if one will turn into the other. It's always the big question in my brain here. It runs through my family. So a couple years ago, I'm with my wife, and I get pulled over by a cop, a highway patrolman, a little short. I'll never forget this little short woman. And I was having trouble talking to her anyway because she's short and I'm tall. And I'm scared. I don't get pulled over. I'm the old school. I get scared when a cop pulls you over, even if I've done nothing, right? And I start shaking when I'm scared. And she thought I was drunk. Mm-hmm. She put me through the whole drunk test. And the more she did it, the more I shook.
Yeah.
And I was so scared. I hadn't had a drink. I hadn't had anything. I was just, again, and I was so embarrassed. I was with another couple. And I got run through. And she just would not accept that I wasn't just BSing her here. That I wasn't drunk, that I wasn't being difficult, and I was just
You're fully conscious. I mean, I would imagine on a bad day, you're fully conscious.
Oh, right.
It's just that your body is not playing along.
Yeah, because when you get scared, it gets. I don't know if it's Parkinson's, certainly it's central tremor. When you get scared or nervous, you go on stage. Or what I used to have problems and go on stage, where my hands would start shaking wildly.
That's why he's behind the mic, by the way.
That's why I'm behind the mic.
Right.
Exactly. It's probably true.
And I could tell you. I watch a show on A&E every Friday and Saturday night about police and chasing people down. They do that sobriety test. And my wife goes, you think you could do that? It's like, no. I hadn't
thought about that for years, but I was so embarrassed that night when that happened. Yeah. And they were so convinced that I was just being difficult or drunk or trying to hide it.
We're almost running out of time here. What are you hopeful about? With this, I mean, and let me just say this: being diagnosed with Parkinson's is not a death sentence.
No,
it's just and it's something that could be lifelong, right? I mean, especially if you're getting diagnosed early.
Right.
If you get like Michael J. Fox, if you're diagnosed in your 20s, you're looking at 40 years, 50 years, whatever it is, right?
Right.
And
something you live with,
and so you got to live with it. So what are you hopeful about, Michael? I mean, you've been through the whole gamut here,
right? I mean, my next step would be brain surgery, the deep brain stimulation where they put electrodes into your head, and I have a battery in your chest that controls that. That lasts about 5 to 10 years, depending.
That's what Michael V. Fox did,
right? And I have a lot of friends that have it. A good friend of mine, Joe Narciso, used to be an actor on Law and Order, and he has it done. He had to have it recalculated, and that's my next step.
I mean, is that the equivalent, almost like a breakthrough equivalent of what pacemaker did for.
Yes, it's exactly because you have that. I call it a battery, but yeah. It ultimately is a pacemaker in your chest that's controlling the electrodes.
Hope is what keeps everybody going. Right. Hope of a cure. Hope of the, that you can control it. Hope it won't get worse. Because there's no, he might stay like this for the rest of his life, right. Or he might get much worse in a year or two. Yeah. There is no natural progression to this disease.
No,
there's no one size, no one path fits all.
No.
I might stay just like I am for the rest of my life, or I might turn into, you know, be completely incapacitated in a very short period of time.
And what would you say to people that are at the beginning of that journey, and what would you say to them relevant to themselves and the people around them? Are there any advice that you would give having gone through this?
Trust your family. Don't lie to them. Trust them that they will know what to do. If you're seeing a neurologist, and I have nothing against neurologists, they're great doctors, but if you have Parkinson's, go to a movement disorder specialist.
Yes, right.
Unless there's just not one in your area, but telemedicine that you're able to do
a
it.
A movement disorder specialist.
Yes, right. please, by all means, because
and the benefit is
they're more familiar.
Yeah, Dr. Omidvar specializes in Parkinson's disease, and I mean he'll see other neurological issues, but his specialty is Parkinson's. So there's not a question I could ask him that he's probably. If he doesn't have the answer, he'll get it to me within 30 minutes. Okay. And the other thing is know what you're putting in your body. I didn't know that proteins were bad for me.
Isn't it amazing?
Proteins block the blood-brain barrier, make it harder for your medicine.
Making a connection between nutritional wellness and Parkinson's.
Right.
We had a doctor here a couple of weeks ago. We were talking about the connection between Alzheimer's and nutritional wellness.
Right.
And all the crap that we put in our bodies, and not only is it fat causing, but all the other stuff that neurologically or brain-wise, brain health, it is affected by.
Yeah.
Okay, so
got to go because we got another show back in
another show. But Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you for having
really
me.
Thank you. And finally, let's leave on an up note. He was a Minnesota fan. I'm a Minnesota fan. The most tortured franchise in the history of modern sports.
I thought
sports.
You were going to leave on a up note.
The Vikings. Baby, they did it, and maybe they'll do it again. Or are they just building us up to bigger disappointment?
Did you just throw a Hail Mary?
I threw a Hail Mary.
You know what? I said to my wife, I said, you know what's amazing about this is this stuff doesn't happen for us. It happens against us.
And always.
It's finally nice.
Finally what happened. Finally we got a break.
Speaking of which, I would like to invite you back, Michael.
Okay.
Anytime you feel like, or even call in, right? Because I think this is one of those things I know personally I was touched by it because a very close friend of mine went through it, right?
Right.
My grandfather, right? And it's something that we have to basically figure out a way to deal with. You're living it. So anything you'd like to share, feel free to be my guest.
And that's the key. You have to learn to deal with it.
And
you have to learn to work with it.
Yeah, and I'd love to, at the end of March, I'm going back to Washington, D.C., to ask for funding on a variety of issues.
Would you come back after you come back from D.C.?
Yeah, absolutely.
And let's talk about this a little bit more from a political thing, because one thing you and I talked about we didn't touch on is this becoming politicized as more and more of the population gets older?
Mm-hmm.
Is this and Alzheimer's becoming politicized? I know Alzheimer's is a little bit.
Right.
And with that note, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I appreciate you.
Been an experience and a great one at that.
I appreciate you being so candid, Michael. I think it really everybody who was listening and will listen
very
to this
much
will
so.
Benefit.
Very appreciative to be open and honest about this.
I appreciate it, and I look forward to seeing you in April.
And everybody else, go check out the Michael J. Fox Foundation, michaeljfox.org, and get involved. Get involved. If it is not touching your life now, it'll touch somebody's life that you know or yours.
And don't turn away when you see somebody shake.
Don't turn away,
right.
Yeah.
It's a normal thing. Accept it. Don't stare. Don't make a big
deal
about it.
Unless it's Paul, in which case, call me first.
Yeah. Exactly.
Before you approach him.
I'll make fun of him before I leave.
All right.
Thank you, Michael.
All right, thank you again.
You have been listening to the Rad Life Radio Show with your host and age explorer, Rad Gontos, brought to you on the one and only octalkradio.net. Join us again next week as we continue our journey of discovery into life's challenges, opportunities, options, and all the latest and greatest things that come with getting older.